The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
The main character of Plug is dirty and disgusting, and there's a scene in this film and you see he's got his big mutton chops, he's wearing a hat, he's making these grunting sounds.
The terrible Australian B. Jemine.
Marcy, there's a scene for poor Barry McKenzie where French police shoot up an entire box of Foster's beer with machine guns.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
No, absolutely nothing. There's nothing there. This is shit. This is a shithole of a movie.
Mature themes.
I knew it was going to be a documentary about sex, but I thought it would be more about love and relationships and stuff like that. I didn't realise it was going to be about venereal diseases.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is B. Jemine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome to episode 11 of the Ozbloidcast, the podcast where myself and my co-host Super Marcy take a deep dive into Australia's Ozploitation movement from the very beginning right up until today. And with me as always is my lovely and very Aussie co-host, the one, the only Super Marcy. Hello Marcy, how are you?
G'day you larrikin, what's going on?
Ah, pretty good thanks mate. I'm very excited to be on this show and talking about Fosters, kangaroos, and also those weird hats that have like those bottle things on them.
It's to keep those pesky flies away, mate.
Exactly, exactly. Unfortunately, though, there's no movie, at least among the ones we're talking about tonight, that has any of those things in them, which is a bit sad. Mm. But I am very excited about this episode, Marcy, but... However, though, we have a very special guest on tonight's episode.
Yes, we do. Very excited to have this wonderful individual back with us on the show. It's been far too long since the three of us have sat down and done a podcast and chatted about some awesome movies.
Indeed, indeed. And that very awesome returning guest is the host of the very awesome podcast, Schlock and Awe. And that, of course, is Lindsay Wilkins. Hello, Lindsay. How are you?
I was trying to think of something Australian to say. No, thank you so much for having me. I was so, so excited when you said, hey, do you want to come on and talk about these movies? I was like, hell yes, please.
I think it's going to be a pretty interesting episode because we have a wide variety of different films on tonight's show. We have a little bit of everything. We've got a heist film, we have an action film, we have a slasher film, we have sort of a cult film, and also we even have a movie that kind of mixes fantasy and political intrigue as well.
We do. It's kind of, we'll get into it, because I just recently watched the Ozploitation documentary, Not Quite Hollywood, and just the way that they sort of cover this year is really fascinating in what they sort of don't say. But yeah, no, it's a little bit of everything, and it's kind of, because as I've been listening to your show, this is kind of seems the movies that are slightly moving away from that Australian larrikinism. Is that a word?
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah, it's starting to kind of move away from that. So this is a fascinating group of movies.
For sure, because a lot of the films that we've talked about on recent episodes and some on tonight's show have been produced by Anthony Iannone, who kind of wanted to make films that, even though, yes, they were produced and made here in Australia, but they wanted to be from international audiences and kind of feel like they could be set anywhere else other than Australia, which, again, if you watch Not Quite Hollywood, he kind of dives into the controversy behind that in that film. But like I said, we have a lot of interesting films tonight. And for tonight's episode, we're going to be talking about the films Nightmares, Harlequin, Stunt Rock, Touch and Go, and Allison's Birthday. So we'll get straight to it and talk about the very first film, which, of course, is the 1980s slasher film Nightmares.
Watch closely now, but don't dare look behind you. Just feel the skin crawl on the back of your neck. Something is lurking in the theater, and all the doors are barred, so there is no way out. Look down. 15 years ago, this lovely young woman had a nightmarish experience. Today, she's a grown woman, and her nightmares are still happening. But now, they're all coming true. Bioscope presents Jenny Newman, Gary Sweet. Nina Landis, in a new story of terror featuring Max Phipps and John Michael Housen, Nightmares. The screams of terror in the night are silenced only by a sharp sliver of glass. Now take a look over your shoulder before you leave this theater, because you will never enter another theater in quite the same way again. Many motion pictures promise you terror, but Nightmares is truly frightening.
Which was directed by a filmmaker we have talked about a lot on the show recently.
Yeah.
Which is John D. Lamont, who of course directed Australia After Dark, which was a few episodes back. You were
I was on that one. I saw his name and went, I know that name. Well, exploitation, yes. But I was like, I remember a certain movie, Australian After Dark.
But also he directed the ABCs of Love and Sex, Australia Style. And of course, the film we talked about on the previous episode, Felicity. And the film was written by Colin Eggleston, who, of course, was the director of Long Weekend, from a story by John D. Lamont and John Michael Housen. And this film stars Jenny Newman, Gary Sweet, Nina Landis, Max Phibbs, John Michael Housen, Bryony Barrett, who is a name who keeps popping up a lot on this show, Maureen Edwards, and Sue Jones. And the plot summary for this one is... A stage actress who is hiding a deep trauma over the car accident that killed her mother finds herself living in a new nightmare when her fellow cast members are butchered by a glass-wielding killer. Now, I'm going to make a slight little change tonight, because usually, Marcy, I always start with you. But since Lindsay is our returning guest, I would like to ask you, Lindsay, what are your thoughts on Nightmares?
I had a lot of fun with it, actually. I know it's sort of described as a slasher movie, but it feels more giallo to me. And I know this is kind of especially with, like, what's a giallo, what riffs on giallo and what doesn't, but the black gloves and the very sleazy that only John Lemons could do, and people getting completely naked to have sex in an alleyway, which we'll get into, it honestly felt like much more of a giallo movie. There are times when people looked like they were dubbed. So it actually... feels like this is kind of what Australia's giallo movie, and I actually had a lot of fun with this one. It was it was a lot more fun than I expected.
And Marcy, what are your thoughts on Nightmares, which is quite the departure from John D. Lamont, since most of his films in the past have either been very sexy documentaries or very sexy dramas.
Yeah. So Nightmares. So the movie Night Killer is basically this movie, just with some differences. So Nightmares was the original Night Killer. As Lindsay said, this is, I had fun with this. It's very silly. There are a lot of laugh moments, but you're spot on. There are those giallo-ish elements. And it makes it more funny in a way, because nothing quite works the way it should in a film like this. The dialogue is horrendous. The acting is on, I don't know, they're on another planet or something. It's just very silly. So I think all these little elements together, this makes it a great comedy, not a great horror.
I would agree with Marcy. It is a better comedy than it is a horror movie, but... because I know a little bit of John Lem, is it Lemon? I can't, my notes are.
John Lamont.
John Lamont, sorry. Because I've seen some of his work before, I'm just like going, oh, I can just imagine him going, oh, it's a bit of fun, darling. Like when someone's having to get naked and covered with blood. So it kind of feels like he hasn't lost any of his Lamont-ness when he's trying to make a horror movie. And so it sort of turns more into a comedy. Mostly by accident, but in that, I did still had a lot of fun with it because I think there's a really kind of homemade sweetness in the fact that Gary Sweet looks like he's 12 years old. Yeah,
he does.
He does. He's so young.
And he's got hair too. Let's not forget.
Yes. Gary Sweet, young in hair, was just, I was like, who is that? What? Yeah, I was a bit, oh my God, that's Gary Sweet.
Yeah. Beej, share your initial thoughts on Nightmares with us.
I'm going to say this. This is definitely not a good movie at all, but it made me laugh so much during this entire film. Like, I could definitely see the Night Killer comparison, Marcy, and that was pretty much spot on because it definitely has that feel, but with maybe a little less insanity compared to Night Killer. But I gotta say, a lot of the times, the tone of this movie reminds me of the Spanish slasher film Pieces as well, where everything is just dialed up to 11, especially in the acting apartment. And Jenny Newman, who plays the lead, has to give one of the worst performances I have seen in any movie in recent memory. And it just made me laugh so hard, especially in moments when, like, there's this scene where someone sort of badmouths her. And, like, our audience won't be able to see this, but her facial expressions were just like, like, it just made me laugh so hard. And she's like that throughout the entire film. Like, pretty much every performance in this movie is so bad, but they kind of work for the insanity that is this film. And I was kind of curious about this film being that, you know, it's John D. Lamont, and he, you know, we've seen his other work before prior to this episode, and I thought, okay, he's doing like this horror film, let's see what he can do. Like, it is very, like, this film is what I imagine John Lamont would do if he did have the reins of a horror film. It's very sleazy. It's very mean-spirited. Like, there's a lot of gratuitous nudity and very graphic sex scenes for no apparent reason in this film. The story really doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Scenes just happen for no reason at all. And I'm still trying to wonder what the hell the play within this movie is, the story behind this play within the film that the actors are all a part of.
It's a comedy about death, Beed. A comedy about death.
Yes. Death is funny. Yes. Apparently.
Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. Because a lot of the death scenes in this movie were quite hilarious.
They kind of were, though, to be fair.
Yeah, and they were actually. This movie death is very funny.
And also, I love the fact that this movie really hinges on this is going to have a twist, but the twist is the most obvious twist in the history of cinema because it doesn't even do that good of a job to try to hide what happens at the end.
It's so obvious, like, exactly what it is. Like, you're not going to be surprised remotely at all.
Considering this has the same introduction that Silent Night, Deadly Night has, as in you're going to get the kind of why Bobby or something, I can't remember. Gotta watch this.
Billy.
Why his brain is fractured when it comes to Santa Claus. This does the exact same thing and then tries to go, no, but she might not be the killer. And it's like, no, she's the killer.
She's totally
the killer. She's changing her accent every scene. Like, I don't know if she's meant to be Australian or American, but she's
the killer. I had no idea.
the younger version of Kathy, or Helen, as she renames herself as an adult, like, is definitely a young Australian girl playing that role.
Yeah.
But when they cast Jenny Newman in this role and she has an American accent, I'm like, why? When did this accent come from? Like, I would get it if she went overseas for a while and then developed an accent and then came back, but it's never explained at all why she has an American accent.
And then she'll try and have the Australian accent occasionally. Like, a few times she'll suddenly remember, oh yeah, I'm meant to be Australian. John D. Lamond is not the kind of director who's worrying about things making sense and things following each other in a consistency. But yeah, it was just bizarre. I was just like, wait, what is she meant to, what's going, at least have this, yeah, I don't know. It was, it was strange, but it added that kind of, is this being dubbed or what is happening?
Yeah, I know. It was so just, I was so confused.
Yeah.
I felt like I should have been sitting here like recording a To Be Tuesdays episode on nightmares because I was just like, this is perfect. And I just want to like...
on Amazon, change one episode to a special bonus Amazon episodes.
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to be sitting there commentating with everybody about this really weird movie. I will say though, with our little discussion and stuff, I think a really good triple feature for just some definite like absolute schlock would be Nightmares, Pieces and Night Killer.
Yes.
I was Book thinking, that Astor Theatre.
Yeah, I was, oh my God, I'd be there in a heartbeat. Yeah, I was thinking a lot of Pieces when I was watching this. I'm like going, if this was just a touch higher, like in pitch, this would be Pieces, but I never quite wanted to go to that complete extreme where you have people screaming and, I'd like to introduce you to my Kung Fu professor kind of thing. But it's definitely kind of going there, but it doesn't have the kind of thing to go, oh no, we're just going to go completely nuts. If this went Night Killer, Pieces, Blood Rage kind of insanity, I think this would be, this is one of those great horror classics, but because it seems to want to hold back a little bit, it doesn't. I love the guy who plays the director.
Max Phibbs,
and of course, John Michael Howson's whole thing of just wanting to try and sleep with everyone is amazing. But it just, other than that, it doesn't quite go to that level I quite wanted it to go.
I kind of did enjoy John Michael Howson's performance as that kind of stereotypical cliche critic who hates everything that he sees and looks forward to kind of tear down anything that he's about to watch. And apparently in my research, the character is actually based on a real person who... The film is called Bennett Collingswood and... and the person that it's inspired by was a real life Australian film critic named Colin Bennett. So they're not being very subtle at all, because apparently Colin Bennett was very critical of Australian film. So I think that's why they like took the absolute piss out of him and made him basically into a perv in this film.
Oh yeah, because
I think that's basically
everyone.
Like film Twitter these days, right?
Pretty much. Yes. Yeah. I mean,
sorry, Lindsay, I cut you.
No, I was just saying he's whoring on everyone, and it's kind of like in the Godzilla 98 movie of how there's a character called Maya Ebert in there. Mm. So it's just it's always kind of that kind of thing in movies how you take down the critic, but I do like John Michael Howson's performance. I think it is absolutely adorable just how. Was he actually an actor? Was he a presenter? Because I only have a memory from him from when I moved here.
I think. And he was in this day and age.
He was a talking head. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think in this day and age, he's definitely a presenter, but he would pop up in a lot of films during the 70s and 80s. Yeah. Like, I sort of realize now he's popped up in pretty much most of John D. Lamont's films right up until Nightmares, because for some bizarre reason, he had little bit parts in both. Australia After Dark, the ABCs of Love and Sex, and Felicity. So they must have been great friends, and then this come up with the plot of this film. And when I was like doing my research on Nightmares, like I watched some of the special features and on the Blu-ray, which recently came out, and also did other research. And I love the fact that basically, John D. Lamont pretty much admits like, yeah, he made this film because Halloween came out and was a huge hit. So obvious. And pretty much like he found an investor who wanted to invest money in something. So he told them he had this script for a horror film called Nightmares. But the thing is, the script wasn't written yet. So basically what he did was he got the script to The Exorcist, took the title page off and put Nightmares on there instead and said, oh, the script's almost ready to go. We just need the money. It's, oh, can we read the script first? And he's like, it's not quite finished yet. So you have to invest the money first before it's finished. And mainly because the script hadn't been written yet. and also, I don't know if this is actually true or not. Before Jenny Newman was cast, and they always set on getting an American actress for the role, again, for some reason, apparently some of the actresses who turned up to audition for this film included Michelle Pfeiffer.
What?
Daryl Hannah.
What?
And Melanie Griffith.
What?
And somehow, Jenny Newman was the better person for the part. And also,
you know, this film was already too good for this movie. I would have loved to see Michelle Pfeiffer in this, just for her to class this up. But oh my god!
And also, this was the first Australian film to use Steadicam in it as well, which I think they wanted to get because, again, Halloween did it, so they thought they would try to use it as well. But like I said, like you both already stated it already. Like even though, Lamont kept saying like this is a slasher film, but it definitely has a more of a giallo vibe to it, especially with the black gloves and using the kind of more off-kilter weapon to kill, which is shards of glass. Mm. And you never see the killer's face at all throughout the entire film. So there's definitely, it definitely feels more of a giallo film than a slasher film. But that being said, though, even though it is a very entertaining watch, it is so hilariously bad that you just can't help but laugh and laugh and laugh throughout all of it.
That sums it up.
Yeah, no, I think I give it because of who the director is. I'm like, oh, this is of course the kind of slasher movie he would make. Though I like the fact, it does feel more giallo, but I'm like, of course, this is the kind of, he made this on the fly. He just got some people who he could pay probably very little. I'm guessing that Melanie Griffith was asking for way too much money. And as she should. And it was that kind of just throwing this thing together. And then, because it felt very improv-y at times, like they were just told, okay, go yell at her or have this weird constant running joke of the girl who keeps threatening to quit but never does. And even the director's going, can you please just quit? I don't like you. And that kind of thing. So it felt, if someone had told me that the script was just on the fly, I would not be surprised.
And according to IMDb, now I don't know if this is true or not, but it would not be surprising to me if it was true. The murder of the couple in the alleyway was added to the film after principal shooting had wrapped. So it almost seems like
Lamont was like,
Lamont must have been like, we need some more kills and more nudity and sex in this film. Let's just have this random scene that has nothing to do with the rest of the movie in there where a random couple gets killed. Because, and now that I think about it, like all the people who get killed had something to do with the play.
Yeah.
But those two characters, the couple, are the only ones who have nothing to do with anything.
No. Who gets fully naked to have sex in an alleyway? I mean,
it's gross.
It's gross. That is so gross. I get the quick shag in the alleyway, but what the whole fully naked thing? I'm like, going, no, that would not even in King's Cross. This would not be a thing at all.
No,
there would at least there would be still items of clothing on. But they keep flashing back to that because every single time this character's having like a mental. Is about to kill the flashback to the people in the alleyway. So it was kind of fascinating that was her first, I don't know when it was going on or what was going on, but that was the moment she kept flashing back to as soon as she was going to kill some other naked person who was having sex in backstage.
See, that's the thing I sort of knew right away. I was like, oh, she's the killer. As soon as she had flashes of the murders, I'm like, oh yeah, she's totally the killer.
Otherwise it makes no other sense. Why would she be having flashes of just random things? They're not establishing a
psychic connection or something.
Yeah, that's the word I was trying to think of. Yeah. It's like, it'd be obvious. Mm. And she's very triggered by people having sex.
Yes.
Exactly. And because, the opening is just hilarious because, some random dude is trying to hook up with her mum in the front seat of the car. They get in a car crash. She goes flying through the window and the daughter tries to save the mum, but all she does, as soon as he pulls her, her mum's neck gets even more cut up on the glass, which is just like, wow. Yeah. Like, this movie starts off with a bag and just gets more and more insane from here.
Yeah.
I guess that could be a wrap on nightmares. So, Lindsay, tell us your... Yes, exactly. So, Lindsay, what are your final thoughts and rating for this film?
Oh, still worth a watch. I think this movie is daft. I don't think this movie had any thought putting it together. Bless Lamont. Bless his sleazy, greedy heart. But no, I really enjoyed it. I think it's a fun kind of midnight movie that you would watch like at midnight and just kind of with a crowd and just go, what the fuck is happening?
And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating on this film?
I give this one 2.5 being completely traumatized by the things in your childhood out of 5. It's definitely worth a watch. It's just a really silly little movie that you'll just be laughing. I mean, it's not good. It gets the 2.5 just for being as weirdly comical and entertaining as it was. So, yeah, and beat.
I'm going to give this 2 out of 5, but I'll say this. It's a 2 with love. This movie is absolutely hilarious. Like, I kind of had an idea of what to expect when I went into it based on its infamous reputation, but it definitely succeeded way more than I expected it to be. Like, it definitely is a film that you have to watch as part of a marathon with Pieces, Blood Rage, and Night Killer as these kind of crazy and insane, like, slasher films. And if you watch those 4 in a row, it pretty much starts off kind of simple and just goes further higher and higher on the Richter scale in terms of insanity. But yeah, I mean, it's not a good movie at all, but it is a hilarious and entertaining one. So once again, 2 out of 5 from me with love.
Well done. Well done, Bede.
But we'll move right along to our second film tonight, which of course is the 1980 dark fantasy thriller Harlequin.
I know nothing about politics, Senator, but I do know about magic. And I know there are powers at work in the universe. To those higher powers, the dematerialization of a given target would be child's play.
A top politician disappears without trace. An accident or assassination?
Mommy!
A dying child recovers without reason.
Do you want to die? To rot?
A miracle or fraud? Only the Harlequin knows the answer.
In old Italian comedies, the Harlequin couldn't be seen by other characters, only by members of the audience. It's moved.
The senator fears him. The woman loves him. The manipulator wants to destroy him.
There is the edge. Only the wind separates you from the rocks. What do you feel?
I think you push people into the deep end.
The deep end is always with you. All you have to do is fall.
Alice, in our own house, Alice, right? Now, was that before or after he slept with you?
I'll hold him if I have to nail his hands to the wall.
Harlequin, he's the ultimate paradox. Find him and he isn't there. Kill him and he will not die. He's the man with the power over mind and matter. Love and hate. Life and death. Harlequin, is he the new messiah or a demon from another world?
Which was directed by Simon Windsor, written by Everett DeRoach, and it's the two of them coming back together after working previously on Snapshot. And the film stars Robert Powell, David Hemmings, Carmen Duncan, Gus Mercurio, and Broderick Crawford. And the plot summary for this one is an enigmatic faith healer who appears to possess genuine magical powers and a political fixer vie for the influence over a senator and his family. Now, Lindsay, there's definitely a lot to talk about with the film Harlequin, but share us your first initial thoughts on this film.
I loved it. Spoilers, this was probably my favorite out of the 5. This was a hoot. If you go back and watch the Not Quite Hollywood, this is a movie that they skim over. Like, oh God, yeah, that Tommy made the magical political movie. Okay. Same with Nightmares. I was like, yeah, it didn't quite work. But I think, David Hemmings is slightly deranged as this politician. Like, you can tell, I don't know what he was on or what was going on in his life, but he has this really weird energy. I love the whole thing is about Rasputin. And it is just this kind of political parable about with Australian politics and all that kind of thing. And I don't know. I just really had a blast with it. I just kept grinning. My grin just got bigger and bigger the more I watched it. So, no, I absolutely love this movie.
And Marcy, I know this was a first watch for you. Tell us your thoughts on Harlequin.
Yeah, I do distinctly remember like seeing the cover at the video store on like a VHS. So I'd known of the movie, but I never knew like what it was about or anything. And I probably hadn't thought about it for the longest time until kind of, you know, doing this podcast and it coming up to watch. So I was quite, you know, excited to check it out and actually discover what it was about. And yeah, finding out it's like a modern for the day kind of retelling of the Rasputin story, but doing it with, you know, this, the modern for then, you know, political atmosphere in Australia. It's quite an interesting like kind of way to do it. Like, yeah, there is some magical stuff in there and some of it is quite hokey because, you know, budgetary constraints. It's, you know, the start of the 80s, they didn't have the best stuff to do these kind of things. But I think there was a lot of really good ambition there. And the way it kind of tells the story and how we go through it, like we're kind of sitting there like, do we trust the character of Gregory Wolfe, played by Robert Powell? And because it centers around like the politician and his wife's son who has leukemia, and this guy just rocks up one day and claims to have cured boy from, you know, leukemia. But, you know, as more things spin around and we find out more, we start to question the authenticity of Gregory much less as we see what the other powers at play are doing. And it leaves you sort of, it's kind of like, it ends up being a little bit philosophical at times. And I just thought it was a really well acted, well paced, visually interesting film with lots of different themes and just kind of blending a few different stories together. Yeah, I thought it was quite an interesting film. Like, really glad I finally have seen it. And I wouldn't have got it if I saw it as a kid at all.
Well, this was my second watch for me. I did watch Harlequin probably over 10 years ago because, I like both of you, I did see it in the documentary, not quite Hollywood. I do now remember, like you say, Lindsay, it was kind of skimmed over in terms of that documentary. At the time when I first watched it, I thought, oh, yeah, it was okay. A little bit dull in spots, but interesting, but not really for me. But now rewatching it again the other day in prep for the show, I got to say my appreciation of it has grown a lot more. I actually think this is a legit great movie. That it's definitely a lot better than I think a lot of people gave it credit for, especially the people behind this film. Because it's an interesting, like, you mix of so many things. And like you say, Marcy, does a modern, at least at the time, a modern day retelling of the Rasputin story with this kind of political intrigue that's under it, which, you know, you got to remember, even though this movie came out in 1980, the 70s were full of very politically kind of conspiracy intrigue type films like Three Days of the Congo or The Parallax View and quite a number of other films. So it's almost like this film from Simon Winsor and Everett DeRoche, they wanted to make a film exactly like that, but add a bit more of a dark fantasy element to it, which I actually think makes it quite memorable of a film. Even though this was an Australian-made film, I think this might have been set in the US. At least that I think it is, because, like, again, you got, you know, Carmen Duncan, who uses her Australian accent, you got David Hemmings, who uses his British accent, and you got quite a, you know, and Robert Powell is also, I believe, British as well, and Broderick Crawford, who's American. Like, I guess they kind of didn't really... Now that I think about it, I guess they wanted to make it set in a place where it could be set anywhere. And that was like what producer Anthony Iannotti was kind of going for, making almost like these films are kind of countryless, like they could be set anywhere other than, you know, in Australia. But even then, though, like, it's still a pretty compelling film. Like, it starts off with a bang because I completely forgot, like, the opening of this film was very, very much obviously inspired by the disappearance of Prime Minister Harold Holt.
Yeah.
And for those out there who don't know what happened to him, is that he went swimming one day and basically disappeared. Like, this film kind of does its own version of that. But of course, it adds the political intrigue that makes you think, like, maybe what happened to the previous senator in this film might not have been an accident. Like, they might have been assassinated. And I guess, you know, in the last couple of years, given what's been going on in the world politically, the film feels kind of relevant to me, with David Hemmings being like this kind of pawn in a much bigger game. Like, the character of Doc Whelan, played by Oscar winner Broderick Crawford, like, they're kind of using him for their own gain in what they want out of politics. And of course, you got Robert Powell's character, which what I really love about his performance, like, he is so magnetic throughout this entire film, but you're never really sure of his game. Like, does he want to help the senator and his family, or does he have his own evil ulterior motives? And I like that the film never really kind of shows exactly what is going on in this guy's head. Like, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? We're never really quite sure. But the only thing we do know is that Doc Whelan and his crew just see him as a threat. Is he really a magician? Is he just knows how to do really good parlor tricks? Like, it's really interesting. And I think what's even more interesting is that even as great as Robert Powell is, apparently the role was originally written for David Bowie in mind.
Oh, yes. That would have been,
quite something.
That would have been amazing. And apparently
they did reach out to him, and they almost got him. But at the last minute, they had cold feet, the producers. So they decided to go with Robert Powell instead.
Damn.
I could see David Bowie, like, killing this role, but I think Robert Powell still did an amazing job in this
film. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Robert Powell's amazing. He played Jesus multiple times. Like, I was going through what he did, and he was, like, in a series. He was in a BBC television movie. He's, like, a Shakespearean actor. So I think having that I've played Jesus kind of thing really helps for Gregory Wolfe. And going back to what Bede said, the movie always felt very Australian to me, just because I felt so much Australian political stuff happening in the 70s. I can't remember when Harold Holt went missing, but my favourite thing has always been about Australia is that multiple pools have been named after him, which I got.
I know, right?
In Australia. It's amazing. But no, I also got Gough Whitlam vibes throughout the whole thing. Like, the political situation wasn't particularly stable. And now I don't know huge amounts about Gough Whitlam, only that he famously said, "God save the Queen," because no one's going to save the government general, all that kind of thing. But I do know he was outed and not giving credence to any of these conspiracy theories. You do hear that the CIA was involved, so when you have an American coming in, I'm like, oh, they're tying all these, like, threads that have been rumors that have been going around Australia, whether they don't mean anything, but that kind of is what happened with Rasputin as well. He was one of the greatest scam artists in history. That he could actually cure Alexandria's, who was the Tsarina of Russia, her son who had hemophilia. And he could perform these amazing kind of things, and or being channeling through God. And I don't know, there was all these little undercurrents to this, and just the way Simon Winsor would shoot it. Like, sometimes it looks like a miracle, and then sometimes you can see Gregory Wolfe doing something, and you see the trick as it's going down. It's like, okay, when he's about to cut off that woman's finger, you can see, because it's shot from the angle, you can see that he's actually not going to do that. He's got a phony thing there. So it's amazing how this movie plays with you going, oh, no, he is this mystical figure magician. No, he's a complete huckster. He's just really good at scamming this family, whatever. And you never know why he's doing anything either. And he could be like the Joker, the fact that the clown makeup isn't as particularly weird. But I don't know. I loved everything about this movie. This was like, this was a pure treat.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I also realized, again, I forgot to bring this up, not only did they try to go after David Bowie for this movie, Orson Welles was in talks to play Broderick Crawford's role.
Damn.
And they almost got him too. Yeah, they almost got him too, but Orson Welles wanted like $80,000 for a week for 2 weeks' work, so they just went to Broderick Crawford instead.
Hey, to be fair, buying alcohol when you're traveling is difficult. It's expensive.
Can you imagine, like, David Bowie and Orson Welles in the same movie? That would be kind of amazing.
In an Australian movie?
Yeah.
Would have been very interesting. But, yeah, like, I agree with a lot of what you've said. Like, it's just a very interesting film. It's really intriguing. I don't feel like there were too many kind of slow bits or anything. I really wanted to like the child at the time actor who played the son, but I don't know, yeah, I don't know, just his kid performance was kind of shit and annoying at times. Like, I know I shouldn't have laughed, but I was kind of laughing when he's holding that kid over the cliff and I'm like, what?
That's hilarious. Only fears fear itself, do not fear death. Oh my god, that guy seems surprisingly calm when he's watching him do it. I mean, he gets out, but I'm like, that man's holding a child over a large cliff. He's just standing there going, huh, okay.
Yeah, I laughed a bit too much.
Although sometimes while I was watching his performance, I couldn't help, it's like, is the kid being dubbed? It looked like half the time he was being dubbed over.
I was getting some Bob from House by the Cemetery vibes from him, oh for sure. Oh my gosh. Which is probably why how much I love this movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, now that I'm sort of hearing about, like, all, like, the Gulf Whitlam type of stuff, that kind of makes sense. Maybe, like, they wanted to make a film that had all these things that are happening in Australian politics at the time, but again, give it that kind of international flavour, add a little bit of the Rasputin kind of elements to it as well, and create a film that kind of just feels so unique and different. Like, it's, again, like, Robert Powell's performance is very unpredictable. You're never quite sure what he's going to do next. Like, is he going to do something bad to the son, or is he just really just there to help out? Like, you're just never really sure. It's just, even though I had seen this movie before, but this time though, I was just even more taken in by the story. And also, you know, Carmen Duncan is also really good in this film as well. And like, I kept seeing her in this film and I'm thinking, why, where have I seen her before? And I realized when I looked over her filmography, she's been in a lot of stuff I've seen in the past, and you know, she's been in a lot of TV shows as well, so that's probably where I've seen her from. But I found her really compelling in this film too.
Yeah I think most of the performances are really, really good and really strong. And look, I think my favorite performance is probably Robert Powell, and he is perfectly enigmatic as Gregory Wolfe. Really, really, you just can't take your eyes off him. I think he's just very good.
Oh yeah, and also Brian May's score. Not that Brian May.
We always have to mention that.
And even our good friend Pete over at Dingo Ate My Movie has to do the same as well. So,
Brian May's score. Brian May score. What movie didn't he score? Like, seriously, every Australian movie comes
80%
from 1970 through to like, I probably the mid 90s has Brian May, not that Brian May, our Brian May, on it. So it's just, I'm just curious, like, did he just, he must have scored everything.
Oh, it feels like, you know, 80% of the movie, of Australian movies at this period were just Brian May did it.
Yeah, I mean, not only did he score this film, he also scored Nightmares as well.
Yes! I saw his name there and went, oh, of course he did. He was the one who scored all the movies.
Yeah. He pretty much scored like at least 80% of exploitation cinema.
Yeah, there's been quite a lot and quite a few we've already covered, obviously.
Yeah.
Indeed.
But funnily enough, apparently Dr. Giggles was one that he worked
on. Awesome.
Masterpiece.
It is.
Now, before we wrap up our discussion on this film, I have another bit of information that's going to blow both your minds. Now, at the very end of this movie, you know when we now know that Gregory Wolfe is dead and then three kids discover his body in that lake? You know, you remember the little kid in the wool cap? You know who that is?
Who is it?
That was Jeremy Sims.
No. What?
Yes, Jeremy Sims, who is an actor and is now these days a filmmaker behind films such as Rams, Lots, Cab the Darwin, and Beneath Hill 60, was one of the kids on that boat.
I'm just sitting here going, like, what?
No. The guy directed Rams got a start in friggin' Harlequin?
That is so bizarre.
I didn't know this until the credits, and I'm like, Jeremy Sims? And it just kind of freaked me out. But even though, yes, this film didn't quite do as well at the box office in Australia.
I can understand. Yeah. Just even though Robert Powell's amazing, just his wardrobe is a little, I don't know why they took the word Harlequin a bit to heart when they could have made him a bit more ethereal maybe, but his performance is amazing.
Yeah, indeed. But the film did receive quite a number of Australian Film Institute Award nominations, including Best Actress and Best Director. So, okay.
Well, that's at least nice.
Yes. But, exactly. I agree. But I will wrap up our discussion on Harlequin, even though we could easily talk about this movie for quite a while, but we do have other movies to talk about tonight. But so, Lindsay, what are your final thoughts and rating for this film?
I gave this 4 stars. I think it is a really strong movie, really well acted. I love the parables. I love how they took everything sort of, but it's not in the text of the film, but kind of underneath the surface of what was going on in Australia in the last 10 years, even though they specifically referenced Holt. I love all that kind of stuff. I thought it was a really interesting piece of work. Because I went in, just because of purely not quite Hollywood, I was expecting this to be a like, ooh, yeah, this is nightmares. We'll see. But no, both of them really surprised me, but Harlequin particularly surprised me. So yeah, definitely 4 stars. 4 out of 5.
And Marcy, what are your final thoughts and rating for Harlequin?
Yeah, I give this one 3.5 Rasputin-like individuals out of 5. This is a really good one. This is a really good one. It's definitely a worthwhile watch. It's not what you think it might be. And especially thinking about like how it's kind of, yeah, like you said, it's glossed over and not quite Hollywood. Like I don't even think they presented it as it kind of should be, because it's not really like some weird hokey magical political film. Like there's definitely a lot of really good and interesting things in here. Like I would actually like, I'm more in the camp of maybe you should remake something that perhaps needs updating in some way or something that wasn't very good to make it better. But I think there could be a lot of interesting things in updating this and kind of remaking it for like today, because I think there's a lot of relevancy there, and I think that would be quite interesting.
Yeah, especially with Australian politics, I think it could be fascinating, because the last 15, 20 years we've had such a constant change of prime minister that I think that could really lend itself really interesting to someone like Rasputin or Gregory Wolf coming in and causing mayhem. With all the backstory. You know what?
It's funny that you mentioned that, Marcy, because during, like, after I watched it, I'm thinking, like, you know what? I wouldn't mind seeing an updated version of this story for today, because there's definitely a lot of potential, like Lindsay said, like, a lot has been going on politically in Australia over the last decade or even just internationally. Like, you could easily up this story for today. And I mean, Anthony Iginiotti has done a couple of remakes of some of the films he has produced in the past, like Patrick and Turkey Shoot. So maybe this is one I think he should think about even like doing an update on, because I think it has a lot of potential.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's a lot like you could, you know, add in for, you know, stuff that's happened in the past, even the past 10 years with politics and stuff. Yeah. But Bede, what about your score?
Well, at the time when I first saw this film, I think I gave it a 3. At the time, but I am upping my rating to a 4. Like, I think it's a really good, compelling mix of dark fantasy and also political intrigue. And I love it when a film kind of mashes two completely different subgenres together and they actually work quite well, surprisingly. And this film does that pretty well. And it's kind of interesting to me, like, Simon Winsor, because this is our second film we've covered from him on the show, because we also covered Snapshot. And it's kind of interesting that you would think, based on this film and also Snapshot, that he would go on to direct Operation Dumbo Drop.
Masterpiece, that is Dumbo Drop. No, exactly. I think both of the and Snapshot have what they have in common is that you think, because I remember seeing Snapshot way back when I was a teenager, it was always that Mr. Whippy killer movie. But then you rewatch it, you're like, oh, wait, there's actually something really interesting going on here. And I think there is with Harlequin as well, there's something really interesting happening in it. And and then he went on to make Dumbo Drop, the masterpiece.
And amazing. And The Phantom.
Phantom is actually generally good. I will generally defend The Phantom. I will definitely,
Absolutely.
We should all defend The Phantom because it is
whole. Because it is awesome. Great.
It is great, yes.
Exactly. But we'll move right along to our next film, which of course is the rock and roll action film Stunt Rock.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sorcery.
Stunt Rock. It's superhuman. Super music. Super magic. And super amazing. You'll be compelled over the edge of sight and sound. And under the spell of mind-boggling action and music, push to the danger zone. It's a death wish at 120 decibels.
Fly in the highest heights. You fly the farthest flights. Living on normal time. Your life is on.
Which I'm very excited to talk about, which of course was directed by the one and only Brian Trenchard-Smith, written by, and I'm probably going to butcher this writer's name, so please forgive me, Paul Michel Mikkel Jr. Again, if I butchered your name, please forgive me, and Brian Trenchard-Smith. The film stars Grant Page, Monique Van Der Ven, Margaret Trenchard-Smith, and the bad Sorcery. And the plot summary for this film is, while working on a TV show in Los Angeles, famed Australian stuntman Grant Page helped an up-and-coming fantasy-themed rock band develop special effects and dangerous stunts for their act. Now, before we go into this discussion of this film, when this film was released, it's a little bit confusing to me because when I was putting this episode list together, at the time, some people said the movie came out in 1980, but now IMDb and a few other places have this film listed as 1978. But the thing is, though, it was released first in the Netherlands, and it's never really specifies when the film was released in Australia or the US or anywhere else. So since the actual proper release date is kind of all over the place, I'm just going to say it came out in 1980. But if it did come out in 1978, we'll apologize for the quite lateness of talking about this movie, so we're talking about it now. But with that out of the way, let's get straight to Stunt Rock. Lindsay, the last time you were on this show, we did talk about another pretty awesome Brian Trenchard-Smith film, which, of course, was The Man from Hong Kong. What did you think of Stunt Rock?
Oh, there's so much Stunt Rock and Stunt Rock. Yeah, no offense to Brian Trenchard-Smith, or what is it, John Mikkel Jr.? There was no script for this movie. No one wrote anything now. They went, go, Grant Page, go kill yourself. No, this is a... I don't know how to describe this movie. It's Stunt Rock. The fact that you gave this a perfect synopsis, I was like, really? That's what happened? No, I have fun with this movie. It's the second time I've seen it. I keep thinking, am I going to like this movie as much? No. Grant Page is hanging on by a wire in front of Mrs. Trenchard-Smith's apartment. Actually, it's an insane movie, and it has wizards battling demons on a concert stage. It's Stunt Rock.
Now, Marcy, we've already covered quite a number of Ryan Trenchard-Smith's films on this show, including his action work with, once again, The Man from Hong Kong and Death Cheaters. How does Stunt Rock compare to those ones and as on its own as a film?
Yeah, I would say this is more on the level of something like Death Cheaters, whereas The Man from Hong Kong actually had a plot.
Yeah,
there's not really a plot. This is just a series of events, and basically it's just like, it's like part stunt movie, part concert movie. And we see all of the, like, Grant Page stunts. Some we've, you would have seen a lot of it in Not Quite Hollywood and some of the films we've already covered. Like, it's so, like, you are just, like, sitting there with full intensity. Like, I can't witness what he's doing. What incredible work. Like, wow. It's so lovely that someone like Brian Trenchard-Smith was, you know, very vocal and very supportive of giving, you know, faces and names to the people who do all the stunt work. And having it kind of mixed in with, like, this band who are very theatrical, and I think Sorcero did, like, that was their actual stage show. Like, they did all those theatrics and everything. And I'm like, it's quite fascinating to see how that, you know, a concert that's, you know, kind of transcends a concert into almost like a theatrical performance. It's just fascinating. It's just fun to watch. There's, you know, little bits of plot, little character interactions, but they're all really good. And it's just, it's a well-meaning, fun, enjoyable film. Like, I don't need a fucking plot. You know, there's little things in there, like, you know, Grant Page forming friendships with the people that are there. Monique Van De Ven, like, I thought their little interactions were very cute, like this mutual respect, and, you know, she wants to do her own stunt work and get in there as, you know, this actress on the TV show and stuff. I just thought it was really, really nice. Nice little fun, freaky as fuck movie. But now, forgive me if I'm wrong, but Phil Hartman, like the Phil Hartman, yes, in this movie. This is his first movie. Like, I did not realize that until a good portion into this film.
I mean, the second watch to realize he was in this movie. Yeah. I was
my mind is still blown. Like, how did that happen? Amazing.
You know, it's funny. I was going to mention that because I thought, like, I wonder if both Marcy and Lindsay knew that Phil Hartman made his first ever appearance in anything in this film, and then you brought it up, Marcy, and I'm glad you did, because that, I mean, I already knew about that even before watching this film, but I can imagine watching this film without any knowledge at all and getting your mind blown when you see it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's like, wait.
Absolutely. Freaking
look over, oh shit, it is Phil Hartman. Wow. Yeah, and it was the first thing was Stunt Rock.
That's incredible.
Yeah, that's incredible.
That is absolutely incredible. Bede, what are your thoughts or initial thoughts or whatever you want to say on this movie?
I agree with both of you. This movie basically has very little to no plot. And basically half this movie does feel like just showing Grant Page just being an absolute maniac in the most insane stunts that have ever been put on Australian screens. And also a lot of it as well is with these awesome, like, concert scenes with the band Sorcery. But that being said, though, I had a lot of fun with this movie. And like Death Cheaters, it's a very much like a hangout movie. Like, even though, yes, it doesn't have that much in terms of plot. Like, there is a little bit, only a very tiny little bit, with, you know, basically Grant Page just going to the US to work on this TV show and kind of more of the friendships and relationships he develops along the way. But it has a really good, nice feel to it. Like, you enjoy these characters. You like hanging out with them. And their interactions with each other are really good. And everyone is so charismatic. Like, I will say this. Having done this show for 11 episodes so far, I just can say right now, Grant Page is a fucking legend. He is the man. And he, again, is an absolute maniac because not only will this man set himself on fire multiple times,
he seems to enjoy it.
He does. He can, and they show a clip from his burn scene in Mad Dog Morgan. He burnt himself really bad, and then he rocks up on set 3 days later, still banned, just like, all right, I'm ready to do it again.
The man, No, I love how much that Brian Trichard Smith loves Grant Page and wants to show what this man can do and actually give him his face. But the amount of times this guy is set on fire is insane. And yeah, that when you're watching him being really horribly burnt in Mad Dog Morgan, that whole magic scene where it's reversed up and all that kind of thing, he feels like he's very calm, even though he's on fire and he's starting to feel the fire. Because I wasn't sure, was his back or his arm that got, only some part of his body actually got really burnt. And he seems very, very calm while standing on the side of a cliff going, oh, shit, I can feel that a bit too much. But what I also love about this movie was that it kind of went through the process of how you do the stunt. So it doesn't only show the fact that Grant Page is an absolute maniac, but it shows that he has this understanding of physics. Like when he's sort of saying, okay, I'm going to be shot at like a catapult, but the gravity is going to do this, the wind's going to do this, and I'm going to do this. So hopefully that means if I've added this up correctly, I'm going to fall here if everything goes according to plan. Now, they don't always do that, but he has an innate understanding of what he's actually doing and how to do it in the best way to not kill himself. And so when he's doing the that rope across the courtyard so we can talk to Mrs. Trenchard Smith, I forgot her name in the movie, you see him tie the knots and how to actually do it. And it's kind of this really smart way of showing, it shows the intent and how this man actually does his craft. It's all about the craft of what he does. And then you see him just hanging off something or hanging off a building, knowing where to put his feet in the cracks of something. It's really smart that way. I mean, there's that attention to detail that shows you, okay, he knows what he's doing. He's not going to die. I'm not going to watch this man die.
And like, again, it's just, he's so charismatic, and I think I've picked up a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I know he only did more supporting or bit parts in other films after this and kind of, again, more stuck with stunts after this film. But between this and also Death Cheaters, which he's, like, the actual leads of the film, like, he is so charismatic and likable that I kind of, like, wish, like, oh, he did more movies, you know, like, as a lead.
Yeah, no, he's wonderful. He's so easy to watch and listen to, and just, you know, you feel like you're his friend when you're watching it. Like, this dude's cool.
You feel like it's a movie where you actually feel like you're having a beer with him, even though it's not that kind of, well, you're literally not. I'm having a wine while I'm drinking this, but it's not like you do feel like you're in a conversation with him, which is cool. Because when I was sort of watching, I was like, oh, I don't think I like the sorceress stuff as much as I thought I did. But then it turned back around and it was playing so much. I'm like, oh, no way. I'm totally on board with the wizard and the demon fighting on stage and doing that trick with the spinning with the sword. I'm back on board. But it was just that because they kind of play it. And I was more like, can we get back to Grant? I'd rather be with Grant than I would be this concert band. Concert band, sorry. This band.
Well, I did like the scenes with Sorcery. Like, I think the songs they sung are really good. And I was really put off by the singer because the singer looks so much like Michael Bay. He freaked me out.
He does!
Yeah, you're not wrong. He totally did. And it was scary.
It was really scary. I was like, oh no, is this what Bay did before he started directing music videos?
Yes.
Kind of sure you would do. I mean, it's got a lot of pyrotechnic, a lot of explosions, a lot of things happening. It's not.
I wouldn't be surprised if Michael Bay saw Stunt Rock and saw the lead singer. It's like, he kind of looks like me. I have found what I want to do for the rest of my life now. But I also like the meet cute between Grant Page and Margaret Trenchard Smith. Like, even though, yes, as plotless as this film is, I do like it's kind of like a little bit of a romantic comedy because it's basically like she comes in because like she hears about Grant Page and wants to do a story on stunts because she's kind of skeptical about the whole thing. And then there's sort of relationship and she starts to get charmed and they have a little bit of falling out. And then he goes up to a telephone wire, hangs off it and calls her from outside her window. And it's like this really cute like scene. And also, the other star of the film, Monique van der Ven, she's really charming as well. And I love that her arc is like, even though, yes, she's an actress, nobody takes her seriously. And she wants to do stunts. Like, she wants to be Tom Cruise and do the stunts herself.
Yeah, she's great. I just thought everyone was so lovely and charming. And, you know, despite this not really having a plot, there's a lot of chemistry and just natural, like, camaraderie. It's just, it's nice. I think it's just a nice, fun film. Like, yeah, I wanted to spend more time with Grant Page, but I did quite enjoy, like, the weirdness of Sorcery. It was a cool movie.
It definitely came back around, but there's a point in the middle where there's a really kind of longer concert scene. Mm. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. We spent a lot of time with the band.
Mm.
I just wanted to get back and hang out with Grant Page and him flirting with Margaret Trenchard-Smith. But I love when she gets upset, because I would be that too. Like, I'm not sure I want to watch you kill yourself. I don't know you that well. You seem to know what you're doing, but you're doing some very dangerous things. As we said before, he sets himself on fire multiple times. He was the guy you went to when no other stuntman would go, I'm not doing that. That's too dangerous. He'd go, yes, I will set myself on fire and fall off a cliff, which seemed to be one of his go-tos, his go-to stunts that he was sort of known for. But he's so charming and so relaxed about it. When he's talking about why he's not scared, it's just like, fear is a mindset. He says, like, I know what I'm doing. I already know all the dangers and what not to do. Because he sort of says, as soon as you lose respect for this, he keeps calling it a craft, which I love. As soon as you lose respect for it, you're dead. Because you don't have respect for the dangers. And yeah, I think it was him I really, really nailed on. But you're right, Monique Vandermeer, who's like was checked out her work. She's also in Amsterdammed as well, and a few other really great Dutch movies. It's just you want to hang out with these people, and I love all the little jokes of the director just never being quite ecstatically happy about the insane things that he's doing, or the asshole agent who goes, "Oh, I don't represent magicians," even though everyone's being, "Oh my god, there's magicians, aren't they amazing?" And that kind of thing. And yeah, you're right. It is a really just good hangout movie, and it's showing a part of the industry that I don't think gets enough attention, that it is the stunt crew. It is how things are actually put together. It's the mechanics of it. And that kind of stuff doesn't get talked about as much, because everyone's more interested in the non-construction, the non-building blocks, the not kind of the boring bits. Well, not boring bits, but the kind of that. They think there would be that. You watch Stunt Rock. They're awesome. But yeah, I generally, you cannot help but not like Stunt Rock.
Yeah.
It's just an easygoing film. And I love that there's a little section in the movie that actually goes into the history of stunt works and films, like where it originated from.
It's kind of like Death Cheaters is a little bit. Just this like love letter to people that do this work. Like they so deserve so much more attention and accolades and the spotlight. And clearly, you know, Grant Page and Brian Trenchard-Smith inspired Tarantino to be like, I'm putting my stunt woman Zoe Bell in one of my movies as one of the co-leads. So none to complain about.
And then keep even though her movies, which I love. Like, yeah, it's great.
Exactly. And she's great at all of them. So not because I met her in real life or anything like that, but that's a whole different story altogether. But anyways.
the fact that she always has her New Zealand accent, even in Hateful Eight, I will always love. She goes, oh, yeah, I'm from Auckland. I'm just like, God damn you, I love you. You didn't even, not even pretending that you're not from New Zealand.
See, if I know Grant Page is in his 80s now, but if he and Zoe Bell ever teamed up for a movie, it should be called Charisma the Movie.
Yes!
And Stunts. Charisma and Stunts the Movie. But we'll wrap up this discussion on Stunt Rock. Lindsay, what are your final thoughts and rating for this film?
3.5 Grant Page's falling off a cliff on fire. No, I really love this movie. Yeah, there's a little bit in the middle with Sorcery that I think I was like, oh, get back to the stunts. Oh, no, wait, you've got a wizard and demon fighting? I'm back on board. Kind of thing happening. And I think it would be a really fun concert to go to. That would have just been amazing. But no, it's a really great hangout movie. You just feel kind of relaxed when you're watching it. And there are some very stressful things happening on screen, but you never feel worried for him. Even when he's on fire, which I keep bringing that up, but yeah.
And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating on the film as well.
Yeah, same as Lindsay, 3.5 out of 5. Grant Page doing crazy stunts, 3.5. Yeah. I think it's just a joyful, charming, just, you know, love letter to these things. It's just a nice, fun experience. Stunt rock rules, man.
Well, I'm going to give this 4 out of 5. I mean, I really enjoyed the film that much. And you know, this film has got me straight away when basically it starts off with Grant Page basically flinging himself out like he's in a catapult off a cliff. And just saw that, so I literally was like taken aback. Like, I literally shout out, "Oh, fuck." And I'm like, "You crazy, insane person, I love you." But no, I think it's even though as plotless as the film is, it is a great hangout film. There's a great vibe throughout all of it. Everyone is so likable and charismatic. The stunt scenes, both the ones that they shot for the film and also the kind of archival stuff, are pretty awesome. The scenes with Sorcery and their concert throughout their, you know, their concerts are a lot of fun, and the songs are great as well. It's just a really fun and likable movie that, with this along with Def Cheaters, kind of just shows how awesome Grant Page is. And they're also both a love letter to stunts and stunt people, which I really love and appreciated about this film. Now, we'll move right along to our next movie, which another one I'm very intrigued to talk about, which of course is the 1980 heist film Touch and Go. It's Touch and Go. It's Touch and Go.
It's Touch and Go.
Which was directed by Peter Maxwell, written by Peter Yeldham, and this film stars Wendy Hughes, Chantel Kanturi, Carmen Duncan, and John English. And the plot summary, which this time I'm reading off from Letterboxd because it's a bit more detailed than the one that's actually on IMDb, is: three attractive socialites working for charity turn to robbery to keep a special primary school for underprivileged children open. Now, I think what's going to be interesting about Touch and Go is, I think us three are probably one of the only few people on the planet who have seen this movie.
Quite possibly, yes. Yeah.
Because on Letterboxd, only 6 people have rated it on Letterboxd. There are no reviews of it at all on Letterboxd. And on IMDb, there's only 1 review for this film. So we're basically discovering a movie that's basically completely forgotten about, or most people have never even heard of before. So I'm ready to dive into this one. Lindsay, tell us your thoughts on Touch and Go.
It is, in the sense that, because I had not even heard of it, I heard of all the other movies except, well, what's Touch and Go? It was more charming than, well, actually, no, I didn't know what I was getting into. I really like the cast. I think it, just because the way we watched it on archive.org, which feels like someone did tape it off the television, because you do get the the ad breaks with the Touch and Go poster, I kind of did feel like I was watching like an Australian soap almost. So I think I kept watching it in that context. So I think it's really fascinating, but it did feel like a 4 p.m. RIP Neighbours, We Miss You kind of thing of... Because the fact that it's socialites, the fact that it feels very suburban, the fact that it's just got all these Australian actors who I recognise in it kind of thing. And that's kind of how I saw it. So, and compared to everything else I'd been watching for this, which is so Ausploitation, and it, even when it was, the movies were slow, they didn't want to lose your attention, so something crazy would happen. And this one is much more low-key almost, except for like when I love the opening. I love the heist. I love John Bluthal, I think it's pronounced, Frank Pickles, if you've ever watched Vicar of Dibley. And so I love all that, but it was a bit of a weird experience compared to everything else we've been watching. So I had to get my mind to go, oh, wait, I'm not watching something that is purely what I think of as Ozploitation, if that makes sense. Even though you can end up Neighbours and Summer and Home and Away, kind of Ozploitation, just in the way we've exported it to the world.
Marcy, what are your thoughts on Touch and Go?
Yeah, like it's so bizarre. Obviously hadn't heard of this at all. And then just seeing like there's no reviews here, there's not much of anything, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And then the copy on archive.org that, you know, is available to watch was literally just someone's VHS rip that they taped it from the TV, paused out commercials as they managed to. Like, it really felt nostalgic, like watching something on the TV back in the day.
Thank you, by the way, whoever did that.
But I thought this was, you know, a fun little, you know, kind of harmless film, just, you know, with these pretty cool, well-performed, like, you know, female-led movie with the leads and, you know, kind of doing this high, like doing heist jobs for, you know, good reasons. And again, there's like some good chemistry between them. It's fun. It doesn't take itself too seriously at all. It tries to keep the suspense up. It tries to keep a bit of comedy. I just thought it was, you know, an enjoyable kind of thing, like something that you'd imagine they probably taped off the TV at like, you know, 3 on a Sunday afternoon or something. And yeah, there's probably the sort of more cheap and I guess more experimental-ish elements, like, you know, having a female-led, you know, action-y kind of film was not kind of what I was expecting because I just went and watched it. But I think, yeah, it's definitely got its charm. It's definitely fun. But I think my problem with it is a lot of it just doesn't make a lot of sense. Like, you're socialites, you're well off. Why do you need to steal money instead of just giving your own to the school? Are you, what, like, is it for the thrill that you're doing the heist? Like, I didn't get a lot of this stuff. Yeah, it was very silly.
It's Marcy, it's very simple. They don't want to give them their own money.
Yeah, like, I don't think they want to give them their own money.
Never give your own money is the biggest rule. You give other people's money.
Yeah, obviously. But yeah, things like that, you just kind of like, eh? And I don't even know what was going on with John English's character at all. Some of it's just very silly. But, you know, it's watchable. It's a fun little film.
Yeah, well, I know for a fact because, like, This is how we did watch the film, was because there is a copy of it on archive.org. But the thing is, there's two copies on archive.org of this film, but I must have watched a different copy because you both have had ads in yours. Mine didn't have ads. Or at least ad
break.
I feel sorry for you. But I could definitely see your point, though, because watching this film, it did feel very TV movie-esque, or feels like an episode of a TV show, particularly like Charlie's Angels or something like that. But I could definitely even see the analogy that this would be a film that you would catch late at night, probably around 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning.
That or 3 o'clock on the Sunday, as Marcy said. But no, it is very much like that. I mean, I really like the cast. The fact that Carmen Duncan also shows up again, though why she's working, she doesn't seem like a socialite. She was the one, was she the one working in the hardware store?
Yeah, she was working like in a store that has locks, so that's why she's the lock.
She was a locksmith.
That makes sense. Locksmith. Yeah. And the fact this movie has Jeannie Drinan.
Muriel's Wedding.
Yeah, the mum from Muriel's Wedding, who I was just like, oh my god, I love you so much. That John Bluthal, who we were going to be talking about very soon in the next movie, pops up in this with an atrocious comedy company accent. I don't know. There's a lot of things that are endearing to this movie, but it did feel like I was watching an episode of an Australian show from the 1980s. That was kind of,
it definitely has that feel. Yeah. Yeah. Like it could have almost been a pilot for a TV show.
And it would have been
with these women kind of doing heists and stuff.
I would have loved that show. I would have totally been on
that. That would have been cool.
Yeah.
It could have been like Australia's Charlie's Angels kind of.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
With suburban vibes. It was great.
Mm.
That's, I think, the thing that intrigued me the most. Like, I'd never even heard of this film again until I started putting the list together. I think, what the hell is Touch and Go? Not even, not quite Hollywood even talked about this movie.
No.
It's like one of the few that they did bring up. But I think what did intrigue me the most is that it's a female-led heist film. It's all women who are doing this job. And in a way, it's like the Expendables of Aussie actresses, because you've got Wendy Hughes, Carmen Duncan, and Chantal Kanturi, three actresses who we have talked about previously on this show, and one who we just did earlier in this episode. Like, they're in this film together, and I would had such a... And seeing the three of them together was quite a joy, because they all have pretty good chemistry. I particularly enjoyed Chantal Kanturi, because she's just awesome and a goddess. Also, just like their camaraderie, and also... It's a pretty easygoing movie. Like, the high scenes are pretty well done. And I like that the film kind of starts off because they're in the skies and you think, oh, it's men doing this. And then all of a sudden you realize, oh, it's women who have pulled off this this heist. And I think that's a good little reveal. Like, if you didn't know already, if this was already a gang of female criminals.
No, I love the fact that they get a friend of theirs to record, like, the male speaking. They're like, you know, if you don't do what I say, I'll blow your head off. And he doesn't know why he's doing it, or the fact that everyone thinks that he's a silly socialite woman and wouldn't have the brains to pull this off. But they're the smartest people in the room. They get everything off without the hitch, except for the gardener not doing what he was meant to do at the end. But it's just this kind of – and plus, Ausploitation is known for being hypersexual. And I love – and I'm not criticizing that, because I love Ausploitation and I love the fact that there is just tits for days. And the fact that you have a core of very strong women – who do not get naked, who do not use their sexuality, who use their brains, who are all very prim and proper, is such a weird thing when I'm in an exploitation mood going, okay, so where are the tits? it's
and also quite, this is...
Yeah.
Yeah, and this film was written and directed by Ben too, so they could have, you know, it could have easily have happened as well.
And all the men, and all the men are idiots, which I love as well. It's
They really are. And it's because of their freaking, you know, stupidity that the movie kind of ends the way it does. But then they're like, oh, well, we can just do it again.
It's like it feels like the pilot of a – yeah, it's like why it feels like the pilot for a TV show. It's like they're going to do another adventure.
Exactly.
I really want to see someone do a release for this, because I think it's a really interesting and – yeah, so I think it's a bit of an important film, because we see a lot of things that we didn't really see all that much back then within, I guess, like this kind of stuff in general. Like, I think it's worthy of a proper release. Get on that, Umbrella.
Yeah, Umbrella. Yeah. I mean, you've released Harlequin. They did Nightmares, didn't they?
Yes.
Yes. Come on. You can do Touch and Go.
You got to bring this movie back into the consciousness of people.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I guess that could be a wrap on our discussion of Touch and Go. Lindsay, what are your final thoughts and rating for this film?
Talking about it more, I think I enjoy it more, because I think you're right. This is a special little movie that I think would do really well with just a little release, Umbrella. So I'm going to give it 3 stars. I think I initially was going to give it 2.5, but I think I've bumped it up to 3. I think it's doesn't have those really exciting kind of big stunt things, but it's really smart. You're just like hanging out with these women. So yeah, I'm going for 3.
Marcy, what are your final thoughts and rating for this film?
Yeah, same as me as well. 3 out of 5. I'm going to go pull off a heist and give the money to underprivileged school children. I just think it's a charming little film. Like, it's fun. It's got some good moments. The actresses are wonderful. It's like this weird little slice that's just there. We got to watch it. No one else probably ever heard of this. Those are my thoughts. Final thoughts.
I'm going to give this 3 as well. Like, it's a breezy, fun, little, easygoing little heist film, which has a very likable cast of, particularly when you have Wendy Hughes, Carmen Duncan and Chantal Kanturi in it. But I also love that if you go on the Letterboxd page for this movie, the poster of this movie looks like it's done for an Andy Sidaris film.
It does. It absolutely does.
And the women on it are not the stars of the film, which I think is even more. See, the poster is probably what, like, could have been if it was much more sexualized and whatnot. But And also, I gotta say, like, even though the character was annoying as fuck in the movie, but I did, the husband of Chantal Couture's character, who's a complete chauvinist, I couldn't help but laugh throughout the whole film because he's completely, utterly hopeless and basically a big nerd.
Oh, he is. So what do you mean? What do you mean you're going away without me? Oh my god, that I've just seen that poster. That is not the movie.
That character is a typical husband.
He is. Who's going to cook my dinner? I don't even cook your dinner in the first place, love. We ever made.
That's just like, fuck off, shut up,
yeah,
piss off.
That dude should have been happy he was married to someone as hot as Chantal Couture. Just yes. Saying. Yes. But yeah, I really enjoyed the film, and hopefully it does get rediscovered somehow and somebody out there re-releases it. That's a cue for you, Umbrella, if you're listening to this episode right now. But we'll move right along to our fifth and final film for this evening, which of course is the 1981 horror film Allison's Birthday.
If there is a spirit in the room, please move the glass towards the yes.
Allison! Murder's coming!
Which was written and directed by Ian Coughlan. The film stars Joanne Samuel, Lou Brown, Bunny Brook, John Blufow, and Vincent Ball. And the plot summary for this one is, which I am reading off Letterboxd once again. On her 16th birthday, Allison Finlay and two of her friends make contact with a spirit who warns of Allison of impending doom on her 19th birthday. 3 years later, on the eve of turning 19, Allison returns home and makes a strange discovery in her family's backyard. Now, I've seen Allison's Birthday before, but I know both of you haven't seen it prior to this episode. Lindsay, what are your thoughts on Allison's Birthday?
Look, I really enjoyed it. It's folk horror. It is suburban witches, which is kind of one of my favorite things. You give me suburban middle-class witches, and I'm usually like, yes, please, then, thank you. Especially when they look like Bunny Brooks and John Blathel. I think it's just a really solid, you can tell, made for $5 on a pizza on the weekend horror movie. I think it dips up and down quite a bit in terms of where you're watching it, but then you'll just see something so kind of strange, and you're just like, are they wearing tuxedos in a cemetery? That you're like, oh, okay, yeah, no, I'm on board. No, I actually really enjoyed this one.
Marcy, what are your thoughts on Allison's Birthday?
Yeah, I actually really, really liked this a lot. It's like a Australian like folk horror. And I honestly, again, just didn't know what to expect. I'd heard of the film, just hadn't seen it. And I think the way it starts off is quite interesting, but then it goes in a very dark direction very quickly. And you're like, what? And then, you know, fast forwards and we see one of the characters again, Allison. And, you know, at the seance with her friends, she gets a warning about something she doesn't quite understand, and her friend ended up dying from this seance because she got possessed and blah, blah, blah. So I was a little taken aback by this beginning, and I thought, oh, maybe it's going to be a bit like, maybe I won't like this too much. I don't know. But as it went on, I'm like, I find this very intriguing, very unsettling, has this very just uncomfortable vibe. And you end up feeling for this character who just isn't paying the right attention that she should. And like her boyfriend seems to be the one who's paying attention a little bit more and can kind of see what's going on, where she's kind of excusing this weird behavior of her aunt and uncle. And as we learn more about what's going on, it's like, ooh, this is interesting. But I really enjoyed it. I quite liked it. And it wasn't really anything I was expecting. I mean, I wasn't really expecting one thing or the other, but yeah, I think it surpassed what I thought this probably was, actually. So, yeah. Beat.
Yeah, well, like I said before, this is my second time watching the film. I believe I watched this as part of my 31 Days of Horror a few years back when I used to have like a month when one day when I would have a double feature of two Australian horror films, an older one and a more newer one. So I decided to pick Allison's Birthday because I think I heard a lot about it in the years prior, like offhandedly in articles about Australian horror, and I wasn't sure what to expect from this film when I first watched it. Sat down and watched it, which was like a beat up VHS rip from on YouTube, which was the only place you could was able to watch it these days. And I think that was the version that was also on Prime Video as of recently. And then rewatching it again, which was actually included in Severin's All the Haunts Are Ours Blu-ray box set, which still is like grainy. A box set of folk horror. Yeah, it's still a very grainy, like it's definitely a brand new transfer.
Yeah, you
it's
can tell.
It's very grainy.
Yeah, like, I love that. Yeah, I loved it, but it's still grainy. Like, and I love the graininess of it, but I was like, oh, wow, this must have been beaten up because this transfer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's definitely a very, like, it looks, so, even though, yes, it's very grainy, it still looks great, but you can definitely tell, like, obviously, like you say, Lindsay, it was a beat-up, like, negative they must have been working with. But that being said, though, rewatching it again for the show in, like, this new restoration of it, I really got a lot more out of it the second time around. Like, Marcy said, like, the opening really kind of grabs you with this seance, and I actually forgot how utterly chilling that scene does go.
Yeah, it really gets like you're just thinking, oh, okay, and then suddenly like she's possessed and then she dies. It's like, what the fuck?
But the thing is though, there's no music at all throughout this entire sequence. It's only relies on sound, and when the girl does get possessed, it's a man's voice coming out, like mixing in with hers. But the thing is, like, her mouth, like her teeth are clenched and her lips are moving, which I think is such a, and they do a lot of close-up shots of her mouth during these scenes, and it's just so unsettling. And then, of course, the girl dies. And then, of course, we flash forward. Like, even though I knew that Allison was, like, involved with this kind of almost druid cult that want to use her because they have this sort of demonic being.
It's like Hereditary, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very similar to Hereditary in a lot of ways.
Yeah, like
it absolutely is.
Yeah, transferring like a demon into the body of someone else, or in this case, a demon was in another body and who's now old, and they have to transfer it into a new one, which kind of reminded me of a little bit of a horror film that came out in 2005 starring Kate Hudson, but that's a whole different story right there. Yeah, and I found it like a really atmospheric, a really creepy little movie that definitely does unsettle you on occasions. Like, at times it did have, again, like, touch and go, it did have that sort of TV movie vibe in certain spots, which kind of makes sense because Ian McCullen, who wrote and directed the film, he did come from television, so he wrote a lot of TV, including writing episodes of the Dearly Departed Neighbours as well. But I still think the film has quite an interesting story. Joanne Samuel, who played the wife of Max in the first Mad Max film, so she's the lead here. I thought she was really good, and also Lou Brown, who plays the boyfriend, was quite good as well. But it really is the supporting cast that were really good, like Bunny Brooke, who plays the aunt. And I was looking at her in this film, I was like, why does she look familiar? And then I realized she played Nell Richards in Round the Twist, which is a show I grew up on.
Oh, I didn't look at her because I was like going, because I watched this before I watched Touch and Go. So I was just, I'm like, Frank Pickles is in a cult? What? I was growing up in and I didn't actually realize he was Australian. I'm like, did they get a Brit? No, he's like, but since when? So playing the most boring man on the planet in Vicar of Dibley. And yeah, but I think Bunny Brooke and John Blofeld capture that older parental figures you have who know how to guilt trip you. Like, you will defend your parents. You can say what you want about your parents, but as soon as someone else starts pushing on them, you will generally defend them if you generally, and they did this thing of the guilt trip. I'm like, oh, I know what this is. This is when she's on the phone and she's kind of like not wanting to go back for a 19th birthday. She's like, that's my 19th birthday. It's not that big of a deal. I mean, what's happening? And she's like, oh, I didn't want to tell you this, but your uncle's ill. She's really leaning on the whole thing. Oh, we took you in and we took care of you, therefore you owe us. But it's really in that guilt trip kind of thing. And I thought they were amazing. I mean, the guy who plays the doctor is incredible. And
Vincent
Bolt. And when you start realizing that nearly everyone in this town or this community that they've set up is in on it is I love when you find out it's like a whole creepy town, like Ride from the Devil, not Ride from the Devil, Race with the Devil, or Buried Alive, or not Buried Alive.
Dead and Buried.
Dead and Buried, thank you. Dead and Buried, when it's that whole thing when everyone's in on the thing except you. That is such a terrifying thing to realize that, like Body Snatchers, oh no, I'm the only one who sees what's going on, yet there's nothing I can do to stop it because everyone is in on. There's literally no escape. And it really captures that terrifying kind of notion of this, obviously the small, I'm guessing around Bondi kind of town. And once she gets back into that house, she's done. They've got her. Then they do the most passive aggressive things to try and get the boyfriend out of the picture. It's amazing.
Yeah, some of that is very just bizarre. But this does not end on a happy note.
No.
It's much like something like, say, Hereditary. Or even like the Suspiria remake, because that has a bit of this kind of stuff as well. And I was thinking about those films. Like, it's not exactly the ending you want. It's not a happy ending. It's far.
It's the ending that the bad guys want. So it kind of feels like I've always seen Hereditary as a happy ending for the cult. Is what they want. This is they achieved what they wanted. You just weren't in on what they wanted. The same with Get Out has everyone dies, which is good. But that kind of thing where, it's like The Witch. It may not seem like a happy ending, but for Aunt Italia Joy, it's a great ending. It's a really happy ending. She finds the devil and goes and hangs out with witches. And so, it's kind of that sense of, the cult achieved what they wanted. But that final thing of when Allison realizes that she's now 104 years old is devastating. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, that older woman is so creepy.
So horrible.
Yeah.
It's so horrible. And you really feel for her after all of this.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, her youth is gone. Yeah, her youth is gone and she is stuck in this body.
Yep. And the thing was, like, I can't even remember the name, but, they get to live on again for another, like, 84 years in young Allison's body.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, that's the thing that's, like, was what really struck me the most about this film. Like, it starts off with incredibly chilling seance scene, and then it ends on such a downbeat note, but it's such a chilling downbeat note when Allison finds out that she's now, her soul is now in the body of, a very old woman. And it's devastating. Like, it is a very devastating ending. And but I guess, like, for me, like, as much as I really enjoyed this film, I guess the only negative thing I can think of, it seems like Allison as a character does get sidelined a little bit in the last half of the story. Because it kind of, drug her, and then the boyfriend kind of takes over as an investigation to find out about her backstory. Like, we find out that she was stolen from a hospital, and her parents who were looking for her were killed, like, obviously by the cult, obviously. Hence, like, when the seance was happening, the spirit of her father comes to warn her not to go back home for her birthday. And clearly that didn't work.
She seemed to forget about that very quickly, by the way. That was traumatizing. And she's just like, I did have someone tell me possessing a friend of mine before she died not to go back for my 90th birthday.
Although I got to say, though, the only thing about that seance scene, as creepy and chilling as that scene is, it made me laugh because all three actresses obviously didn't look like they were 16 years old. They look like 30-year-old women who were playing like 16-year-olds.
But it does also keep the dynamic of always when you're doing a seance as a teenager, there's always one person who's way more into it than the others and is just trying to get. That's usually what happens. It's just like this one person's like really keen to like, let's talk to dead people. And everyone else is just like, I'll do it. What?
That's sort of thinking about it now. And I agree with you, Lindsay. I think one of the things that I really like about this film is that it's very grounded and believable. Particularly the stuff with like the aunt and uncle, like they are very evil characters, but they downplay that evil so much. Like, if you didn't know that they were members of a druid cult, you would think that, they just happen to like guilt trip you into doing things and stuff like that. But they sort of play, Bonnie Brooke and John Blufield, they just play them so normal. which yes. I think all really makes them really terrifying.
They were very, very unsettling. Like, I thought their performances, like, from both of them, I actually really liked because they were so unsettling. And you could tell, like, there's something behind this demeanor that they're putting off. Like, they were great.
It's like, it's like Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener in Get Out. Like, they're playing very normal. Yeah. Like, they're people that you want to hang out with. Like, when they're sitting down, they're these very, very cultured liberal people that you think you're going to be able to get on with. And then as the night goes on, you're like, hang on a minute. There's something not quite right going on here. And yeah, I think Brooke and Blithel, I guess I probably mispronounced his name. Sorry. R.I.P. I loved you. It's kind of that thing of, oh, I want to be, this feels like a cozy home. Wait, something's not right, and I don't know what it is, which I think this movie does really well. Even when she's having the dreams of, and you start seeing flashes of, oh, there they are, there in their robes. It's kind of, I realized, oh, I think it's too late for Allison. I don't think she's going to get out of this. I'll be very, I don't know. Because there's so much dread to the movie that you just kind of, going, oh, this is not, oh, this is a very bad situation. You need to get out of that house right now.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And it's just really effective. It's very believable. And even like in the scene when like Allison finds the stones out the back of the house and she runs into her uncle, you would think like any other normal film would, the uncle would like freak out. Why'd you go back there? You know, you're not supposed to go back there, but he's very calm. Just says, oh, you found those. Like, you know, somebody who lived here previously built those. Like, he's very calm. Like, he probably in his mind already knew something like this was going to bound to happen, and he already had it all figured out.
Yeah.
Like, and again, that's chilling, and because he downplays it so much. It's like, oh, those stones back there, you know, nothing to worry about and all that, which to me is more unsettling than he would have been if he, like, screamed and shouted her not to go back there or anything like that.
Yeah, definitely.
They keep her very, very calm, so they don't necessarily give her a reason, even though they get more angry at him. But when they're sort of having the argument of whether her boyfriend can go to the birthday party, and they're still saying no, and then Bunny switches, goes, no, that's fine. Of course he can come. He's your guest. You're right. We're sorry. We were being silly. And that's terrifying because I'm like, oh, no, what has she got planned? Like, she's obviously thinking of something else that she's got to do. And she just needs to keep her calm because if she leaves the house again, she's not coming back. So it's constantly of how do we keep her in the house? How do we keep her in the house? Okay, this is what we're doing. And it's very chilling.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And I'm glad that it's, I get, well, even though, like, yes, this film's on the Severin, all the Haunts Are Ours box set, it is on Shudder everywhere at the moment. So if people want to see the film, they can watch it on Shudder or also in Australia on Prime Video as well. And I think it's on Tubi as well. So it's easy to watch now. So if anyone
wants to. Yeah, I think it's on a few places. So it's really good. Like, it's pretty readily available, at least, you know, streaming and in that box set. So it's good.
Oh, definitely, good definitely. Enough. Lindsay, what are your final thoughts and rating for Allison's Birthday?
I think I'm going to go 3.5 stars on this. I really liked it. I think it's a touch uneven in parts, but I think those are more nitpicks on my end because I think it's just a really solid folk horror movie and it has all the things that I like in horror. So, yeah, this is very much my jam. So, yeah, 3.5 stars.
And Marcy, what are your final thoughts and rating for Allison's Birthday?
Yeah, I give this one 4 out of 5. Be wary of anyone that has a replica Stonehenge hidden in the backyard. Yeah, I really, really liked this a lot. I thought it was really, really, really good. I was really engaged. I liked just most things about it. Like, I was very impressed. Really happy I'd seen this one. And yeah, just it. I think it's a path. Kind of what I might have thought because I didn't really know what it was, no expectations really, but it's like, oh shit, this is really fucking good. I like this.
I give it about 3.5 out of 5. I really like this a lot, especially on repeat viewing because I think the first time I watched it was about a 3. But I can definitely see some people going into it watching it. It's like, oh yeah, it's good, but it's nothing special. But I think it's still effective nonetheless, even if it has elements we've seen before in other similar films. But it's got really strong performances. It has some genuinely creepy moments, particularly the opening and the ending. A good set of atmosphere, and also it's has quite a few memorable moments as well. And also, even though I was a fan of Round the Twist growing up, I will never look at Bunnybrook ever the same way again because of this movie.
You know she had a replica Stonehenge in the backyard.
Yeah. I think in Round the Twist, everything that happened in that series was because of that Stonehenge. Was
yes!
It?
Well,
that's how much
living
yeah.
But that is a wrap on episode 11 of the Ozploid cast. Thank you, Marcy, for always being a very awesome Aussie co-host for this show.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Lindsay, for coming back on the show to give a Kiwi perspective on these classic Ozploitation films.
Yeah, it's me trying to sound like I know what happening in Australian politics. No, thank you so much for having me on. It's always a blast to get to hang out with you guys. So I always love it. Thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure, as always.
Yes, and you're always welcome to come back anytime for this show. So
definitely. Thank you so much.
We'll definitely organize another one again very soon.
Yes.
Oh, definitely.
But in the meantime, though, Marcy, where can people find us on the internet this week?
Yeah, you can always find us at supermarcy.com. And if you have found the podcast and are listening to it on your podcast player, you can check the show notes for information on where to find us and all of that cool stuff. And if you may be listening to us on the website and you want to check us out on one of your podcast streaming apps, just look up the Ozploitcast or, again, check the show notes. And if you want to find me just hanging out on the Twitter, you can find me at Super Marcy. And I'm also on the Letterboxd at super_Marcy, and I do keep a list of all the films we have watched for this very podcast.
Awesome. And Lindsay, where can people find you on the internet this week?
My show Schlock and Awe, which is on all the podcast apps, you can follow that Schlock and Awe 1 on Twitter and Instagram, or you can follow me, Reading Geek, and I'm also on Letterboxd as well. So you can find me there.
Awesome. And if people were to find me personally, they could find me on my Twitter page at twitter.com/BeJamine or my Letterboxd account at letterboxd.com/BeJamine. And of course, you can find all my work over at supermarcy.com with my reviews and columns. And by the time this episode drops, we'll be in myth season.
Oh, yeah.
So expect my audio reviews throughout the next 2 weeks on supermarcy.com. And I'll cover quite a lot of films for the show. So I look forward to getting back into the cinema to watching films from MIFF or the Melbourne International Film Festival. For all those out there who don't know what MIFF is, after 2 years of being away from it. So
there will be no sleep. Let's just say that. There will be no sleep.
Exactly.
Yeah, but it'll be very, very epic for everybody that's excited to go to the Melbourne International Film Festival.
Yep, definitely. We haven't been there for 2 years, so let's do it. Yeah, so I'm so looking forward to it.
But thank you once again to all of our listeners for enjoying this 11th episode of the Ozploitcast. Stay tuned for the next episode next month, which we will be talking about the films Hoodwink, Center Spread, Race for the Yankee Zephyr, Road Games, and Dead Kids. So we'll have a
just a film called Dead Kids. Lovely.
Exactly.
Dead Kid. Wait, isn't that? Oh, was that Ozploit? Okay, I look forward to listening to that one.
Yeah, that one is a Australian / US / New Zealand production.
Thank you. Yes, it was filmed in Auckland.
with an American cast, including Michael Murphy.
Yes.
So look out for that episode next month, everyone, and we'll see you all then. See you, everybody. Bye.
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 Watch a horror movie right there on my
Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN. Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised. A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi. So just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show. Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal. You can also find the link in the show notes. Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark doo 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 doo. Surfy shark doo 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 doo. And now back to the show.